This podcast is brought to you by Brookhouse College. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, I'm your host, Louise Taffer, with Josh Parrish. Welcome to the show. It's great to have your company this evening. And we've got plenty to get through, a whole host of guests. And remember, you can get involved at any time by giving us a call on 03 99 44 99 99, or you can tweet to us at FNR_radio. In just about 10 minutes, we'll be talking to the Newcastle Jets captain, Nigel Bogard. We'll also be sussing out what's going on down in South Australia. Some big news has come out regarding Adelaide United's head coach Marco Kurz, whose future is now being confirmed.
Yeah, we were talking about it last week, foreshadowing it on, I think it was Friday's show, and the news has been made official after a report in the Adelaide Advertiser today from Val Migliaccio saying his contract would not be renewed. And Adelaide Quick Smart have come out with a statement that Kurz will not be held onto at the end of the season. Apparently the goals of the club are different to Kurz, maybe in terms of playing style and strategy, so they're going to part ways, and it seems as if the ownership change has been the crucial factor in this, but very controversial considering Kurz is, statistically speaking, the most successful manager in Adelaide United's history with, I think, a 1.6 points per game record, which is better than any of their title-winning coaches.
And we'll get into that discussion a lot more deeper at 5:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. The Adelaide Advertiser's Rob Greenwood will be joining us. But there's also been some big news that has been floating around for a couple of days now surrounding Football Federation Australia's support for the AFC president, Sheikh Salman. Now, the PFA have actually issued a statement this morning saying that they are deeply concerned with the notion that they're going to support the re-election of a person who allegedly hindered, you know, Hakim's bail and getting out of prison.
Yeah, not only that, he allegedly was responsible for Hakim's initial arrest. Sheikh Salman, if people aren't aware, is a high-profile member of the royal family in Bahrain, and is, as such, it is a monarchy, a powerful figure in government as well, involved in the sporting side of things, as well as being president of the AFC. And back in 2011, he was put in charge of basically rounding up all the high-profile sports people in Bahrain who had participated, or their families had participated, in the 2011 pro-democracy protests, which accompanied the Arab Spring at the time. And Hakim's family was involved in that. His brother is an activist who I believe is still in prison in Bahrain. So Hakim's initial imprisonment and torture, which he did escape from and managed to seek asylum in Australia, was at least in part thanks to the current president of the AFC, Sheikh Salman, which FFA have announced they are supporting in the next elections. I think it's shocking timing from them, and really an outrage. I know there are political realities in the AFC. You have to play along a little bit if you want to actually make an impact. And the elections for the executive committee are coming up in April, which Chris Nicker will want to get on that committee and maybe start repairing some of those relationships with the West of Asia. But given the whole Hakim situation and how high profile it's been recently, how the AFC, led by Sheikh Salman, did not come to his support when he was imprisoned in Thailand awaiting extradition to his home country, I think it's disgraceful that FFA wouldn't take a moral stance on this.
It is. It is disgraceful, especially given the fact that he was held in prison for 76 days. And then you also think about, you know, how strongly people like Craig Foster and even us here at FNR and all around the country and the world in the football space, people advocated to get Hakim out of prison. Football Federation Australia even advocated to get him out of prison. And now it just seems like they've done a complete U-turn. And it's almost like their agendas are, you know, outweighing as you say, the moral stance of what they should be doing.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're probably supporting him through gritted teeth. I can't imagine that they're enthusiastic in their backing of Sheikh Salman, and it's just politically expedient for them to do so in the current AFC setup. And if they think he's going to be elected anyway, regardless of whether they support him or not, I suppose their rationale would be, we want to be on the right side of this so that, you know, FFA can curry favour with the AFC when it comes time to bid for things like the Women's World Cup and other, you know, issues that need resolving in terms of Australia's relationship with Asia. But I still think that, you know, FFA needs to be a bit more of a robust moral leader in this situation, and especially given, you know, Craig Foster's recent candidacy for the FFA board. That's such turning point potentially, given that, you know, he withdrew from the race due to the fact that, you know, he saw a whole lot of bad behaviour and corruption in that process. He was disgusted by what he saw in terms of the backroom dealings that were going on there. And if we had someone like Craig Foster in charge, I think you would see Australian football, you know, being led in a more a way that was consistent with, I think, a lot of the values that people would like Australian football to hold. And it's just a shame that, you know, that avenue is closed off now. And, you know, we've got, some more, you know, politicians in the FFA board and not, you know, an outspoken leader like Craig Foster, who probably would have delivered a completely different agenda.
Well, that's exactly right. And on the topic of Craig Foster, he did tweet about the whole issue a little bit earlier today, saying the reference to Salman's leadership is sickening, of course referring to Football Federation Australia's statement that they put out yesterday, and they said that he is the best credentialed candidate to take them forward.
Yeah, this is all
mealy-mouthed. Which, again, it's ironic.
Yeah, it's all mealy-mouthed stuff from FFA. And I think they were forced to make that statement after ASEAN came out and said there was unanimous support. They probably would have preferred to sweep that particular story under the rug, but not to be. And I think there needs to be a light shone on things like this. They need to be held accountable for their decision-making. I mean, AFC are such an impenetrable body in terms of, you know, what they deem acceptable. Go back to the Victory shirt sponsorship that we were talking about the other week. I mean, my sources say that they took all of 10 minutes to approve that sponsorship without looking into it at all and doing diligence. They obviously haven't done their due diligence on Sheikh Salman, who, you know, according to a number of high-profile bodies, does not really meet the criteria for being a fit and proper person to stand for any elected office in football. It's not just this Akeem thing. It's a lot of corruption allegations that go back years and years as to, you know, his role with, you know, a lot of the FIFA corruption stuff that went on, the FBI sting operation, whether he actually accepted, you know, dirty money to get where he is today. And I think the AFC needs to clean its act up, but it's not going to if left to its own devices, and FIFA needs to step in and to have a bigger role here.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what happens there. Of course, the election isn't until April 6th, so a few weeks away, but it is looking like Sheikh Salman will be re-elected as AFC president.
I think it's a rubber stamp. I don't think there are any candidates with anywhere near the amount of support that he currently has, which is very unfortunate. But, you know, there seems to be a bit of an ideological divide between the East and West of Asia, and I wonder if that's sustainable going forward. I mean, we've seen a lot of the politics that have gone on in the recent Asian Cup, you know, affected by the blockade of Qatar, and there's going to be all sorts of issues when it comes to the World Cup that's being held there. There's so much going on in the Middle East that really filters down to football. And I'm not sure if the West of Asia and the East of Asia are actually compatible in that sense. Also, the travel, you know, the tyranny of distance makes it, you know, difficult just logistically to hold these kinds of qualifiers and competitions between the two. So I wonder if going forward in the next decade or two, there will be a split between the West and East of Asia, which is something that's been mooted in the past.
It'll be interesting to see if there is. Of course, going back to what the PFA said, Josh, they weren't actually consulted.
No.
And being one of the largest stakeholders, you'd think that they would be.
You would have hoped, but apparently not the case. And I don't think, you know, FFA really wanted consultation on this matter because they knew there would be opposition to their decision to back Sheikh Salman. So I think, you know, their attempt was to just move things along as quickly as possible and hope nobody noticed. But obviously that wasn't the case.
No. You're listening to Evenings on FNR with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And looking at the A-League, we've had a comment come through, Josh, and Pete is joining us. Hi, Pete. Thank you for watching. He said, thoughts on whether or not this move from Adelaide means that the door opens for a move to Brisbane Roar? He's, of course, talking about Marco Kurz.
Very possibly. And I think the door could open for a move the other way, in fact, because John Aloisi is a South Australian. Ross Aloisi is also a former player there. So one of the Aloisi brothers could be in the frame, even both, as a team again for the job at Adelaide United. I think the big question is whether they decide to go local or bring in a foreign coach. If it's a foreign coach, I would expect a Dutch coach, considering the consortium is mainly made up of Dutch. We think it's a little bit in the dark, but the spokesperson is, and the word is that a lot of the backers of the club now are Dutch. So I think that's probably a major schism between Marco Kurz and Piet van der Pol and the rest of the consortium that now owns Adelaide from a footballing perspective, because Marco Kurz comes from a completely different school to the Dutch school in terms of playing style. Apparently, according to Val Migliaccio's article, one of the reasons for the non-renewal of his contract, not really a sacking, but it will be at the end of the season, I suppose, is that he's too results-driven and doesn't promote enough youth players. I'm not sure if the latter is true, considering the number of debuts he's given in the past two seasons to youngsters, but the results-driven approach and the pretty pragmatic style of football we've covered in the past, and I think, you know, it has a ceiling on it, although considering they have the lowest budget in terms of the top six, it's interesting to see him being blamed for the club not, you know, playing beautiful football.
Oh, well, exactly right. And you go back to some of the players he's given debuts to. He gave a debut to young 16-year-old Lachlan Brooke, and I think that was the youngest ever player that they've debuted at the club. So, yeah. Again, reinforcing the fact that he is trying to bring some of the younger ones through. But
sometimes forced by injury, but, you know,
maybe it doesn't align with, as you say, what the chairman and how the chairman wants to run the club.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And I think Kurz will be in demand for another A-League job. Wellington Phoenix might be looking out for him, considering Mark Rudan could be departing the club. The new team, West United, coming in. Brisbane as well are looking for a manager. So I think he'll get another job in Australia, considering how highly regarded he is.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And joining us now is the Newcastle Jets captain, Nigel Bogard. Nigel, thank you so much for coming on FNR.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Nigel, a week's grace thanks to the international break. What's on the schedule for this week, and has it changed much?
No, just much of the same. Obviously, without a game on the weekend, we'll probably ramp up training this week. We've actually been given the weekend off to rest up and recuperate and make sure we're ready for an important clash over there in Wellington.
Nige, it's Josh here, and a really dramatic game on the weekend. Went into the 100th minute, retaken penalties and so forth, and ended it in disappointment. What's the mood in the squad after that one?
The boys are obviously disappointed with the way, first and foremost, we played. We created a number of chances, especially in the first half, to probably win a number of games, and we're probably a little bit wasteful. And once you give a team like Central Coast confidence, they probably went in at halftime thinking that all the dominance and chances we created, we still couldn't score. So they would have come out second half thinking that. And once they pinched the goal, they were quite clever in their approach by sitting back and waiting to get us on the counter again. So disappointing that we couldn't get a result against them, because it would have put us in a good position come this weekend against Wellington. But not everything's lost. There's still an opportunity to gain enough points to make finals. But I think we're starting to get to the point where every game's a must win, and also we're relying on other results to go our way.
Yes, and it's been a common theme throughout the season. You know, lots of chances created for the Jets, but not enough of them going into the back of the net. Can you put your finger on why that is? Or, you know, is it just one of those things, just a run of games in football where luck doesn't go your way?
Yeah, a little bit. I think the luck side of it last year, a lot of things were falling our way. A loose ball in the box was falling to our player, or a ball hitting the post would ricochet and go in as opposed to coming out this year. So, unfortunately, those things just haven't fallen for us this year. But in saying that, the good thing is we're still creating a lot of chances. We just need to capitalise on it and not concede sloppy goals like we did on the weekend. We gave them too many easy opportunities to score, and at the end of the day, like I said, once they got that first one and they had something to defend, and it made it very hard for us. So, yeah, disappointing, but like I said, there's still plenty of hope for the finals and a game in Wellington in a fortnight's time to set that I suppose the result right.
And what's Ernie Merrick been saying to keep the belief up within the playing group?
Oh, Ernie's always positive, regardless of results. Obviously, when we need a reality check, we get one. But he's been good. He understands that the positive signs are that we are creating chances. But yeah, we just need to be a little bit more clinical. And he's always a positive character around the group, and always highlights the good parts of the game that we need to do more of. And probably there's more positives. The highlights and negatives, so it's much of the same in terms of his mentality, the group's mentality. We've always had belief this year that we can make the top six. We're just making it harder and harder for ourselves to get in that position. So it's going to be a good 2 weeks on the training park, and hopefully come next weekend we'll be able to get something out of the game over in Wellington.
And Nigel, we saw you heavily involved in the second goal for Newcastle on the weekend. I thought you might get a nosebleed getting that far up the pitch, but winning a loose ball, putting a nice low cross into the box, and Ronnie Vargas profiting. So are you going to look to maybe swap with Roy O'Donovan, show him how it's done?
Oh, I don't know about that. Roy's obviously a formidable striker, but it's always enjoyable to be up there and contribute in some way. Obviously, as a centre back, you want to be able to help out on set pieces and the like. So for us, we probably needed to contribute a little bit more. Myself, Nikolai, and Lockie Jackson, we probably need to pop up with a few during the year. But yeah, it was nice to be up there and at least get a strike on goal. But yeah, unfortunately, the result, in front of a home crowd, an important round for us with background and recognising the RAF base up here in Williamstown. So disappointing, but we move on and there's still hope.
And how has it been for you, particularly this season, given there's a whole plethora of new attacking talent that's come into the league that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, it's enjoyable, to be honest with you. I think over the years, you start to know the players that have been here for the previous years, and it's always nice to come up against new opponents and new challenges and test yourself against them. And usually, the strikers are usually foreigners or imports that come into the game, so they've come off the back of a high level competition wherever they've come from. So it's always enjoyable, but it's hopefully that continues as the league looks to expand and strengthen, and having new prospects to play against, different coaches, different styles, and hopefully that really gets the league going again, which I think it needs.
And Nigel, I wanted to ask you about one of your teammates, Jair, who maybe struggled a little bit in the first half of the season, but he seems to have gotten over perhaps a hip problem, I think, that was troubling him, and we're starting to maybe see the best out of the Brazilian.
Yeah, he's a quality player, and obviously his CV shows that. Yeah, unfortunately, he didn't really hit the ground running at the start of the season, and a few little niggles here and there, and trying to get himself fit has taken a little bit of time, but you can see during the games that what he can produce and the quality he's got, and at training he's a handful. Obviously, small sided games and the likes, he's scoring for fun. So it's just making sure we can get him the ball in the right areas and allow him to do what he does best. And it's exciting to see him hit some form towards the back end of this season.
And you touched on the away trip to Wellington Phoenix after the international break. You must be pretty happy that Roy Krishna was sent off at the weekend, meaning the Phoenix will be without one of their key goal scorers.
Yeah, of course, it is what it is, to be honest with you. It's not a good thing because, as our coach always mentions, and we've always had the adage that at the end of the day, we'd like to play against the strongest team the opponents can put out. And obviously, he's in some great form this year with his goal scoring and setting goals up. So for us, it would have been ideal for him to go out there, because if you are going to make the six and play finals, you're going to come up against the strongest team with their full squad. So, yeah, unfortunate, obviously, for him and their club, but it is what it is, and we won't focus too much on that.
And I wanted to ask you about VAR, Nigel. I know it went against you on the weekend, you know, long review to work out whether Daniel Georgievsky was in the box when the penalty was taken and so forth. But what is the player's experience of VAR? How does it change the game? Does it change your approach at all when you're defending?
A little bit. It's obviously a lot different than when I first came into the game, and obviously 15 years ago as a professional, and even the way the game's played now, it's obviously not as physical in terms of the way you can tackle and challenge and attack the ball. So it's even that adjustment over those years is something that players, I suppose, of my generation have had to get used to, and now you've got something that's Hawkeye I'm watching over the top of every move. So I think it definitely has a place, whether we're at the point in this country where it's effective and it's being used in the correct way and as a tool that can improve the game. I'm still yet to see if that's transpired, but I definitely think it's got a place. But it's there's still a lot of grey area in terms of the way it's used and the understanding amongst everyone involved.
Yeah, definitely the grey area is something we cover in depth over here. It's probably good content for us media types, but certainly makes it a little bit confusing for the players. I did want to ask you about Kwabena Appiah, who's just joined the club. How has he settled into the playing group, and what do you think he will add to the run to try and make the finals?
Yeah, Cabs is a great guy, and he's obviously got A-League experience, which is good. And I think his time overseas has made him hungry to come back and get back to a level where he was previously. And he's looking sharp at training, and he's going to be a massive contributor to us if we do make the finals. He's obviously he's quick. He's very direct in his approach, and he can score goals. So something that we definitely need. And you mentioned him. He's fitted right into the group as well. He's a great guy, and he's here for the right reasons and wants to be successful. So we're looking forward to him maybe getting some more time on the park over the coming weeks.
And Nigel, there's been a lot of discussion around the country about the fact that some of the clubs have been hindered by the fact that they've taken some of their players off to Oli Roo's duty. Do you think it's really affected the Jets and you know, given the fact that you did lose at the weekend, or are we reading too much into that?
Oh, listen, at the end of the day, we had a squad good enough on the weekend to get a result in our mind. So I don't think that's a reason. In terms of players being taken away for national duty, it's a tricky one for a player to talk about, because if I was in that situation, you always want to represent your country. There's no better honour than representing your country at whatever level it is, whether it's 17s all the way through to the Socceroos. But obviously it was a bit hard to swallow when I suppose our team, especially you take away three key contributors to our squad week in, week out, and maybe some of the other clubs can cope with that, but you rely on the smaller teams to develop these players. So when you turn around and take them away, it does hurt. But at the end of the day, it's a national team, and you don't want to see a player not be able to go and put their hand up for that, because you never know if that's going to come again. So, and by all means, I think the boys have contributed to the games that have already been going on over there. So at the end of the day, like I said, it didn't contribute to our result on the weekend. Yes, it would have been great to have those boys here, but we had a strong enough squad out there to get a result.
Well, Nigel, thank you so much for joining us here on Evenings on FNR, and best of luck for the rest of the season.
Too easy. Thanks for having me, guys.
That was Nigel Bogard, the captain of the Newcastle Jets, kind enough to join us after that heartbreaking loss to the Central Coast Mariners. They thought they had the last-minute equaliser, but ruled out for VAR, and then missing the retaken penalty. I don't think there's a worse way to lose a game, to be honest.
Well, It was good for Ben Kennedy, wasn't it?
Oh, well, he was the hero.
And good for Alan Stajic. First win, first game in charge.
Oh, it was a fantastic win for the Central Coast and a good news story considering just how awful they've been this season.
But interesting to hear his thoughts on something that's been very topical, and it always circulates around, doesn't it? Youth football and the debate between club and country. And, you know, Ernie Merrick actually hasn't come out strongly like some of the other clubs and said, you know, the fact that Graham Arnold has picked three of our players for Oli Roux's duty, it's a massive deal breaker for us. But we have heard that, you know, people like Kevin Muscat, he's come out quite strongly and was against it, as has
Ante Milicic as well. And Mark Bosnich, I should say. It's very interesting, and there's some comments going on our Facebook Live referring to Boz's rant about the under-23. Shall we have a quick listen to that?
Yes.
Part of being a national manager is the fact that you don't have game time with these players. So he's taken out Backus, Mordukas and Madjock, three starting players in Western Sydney Wanderers. We've heard Kevin Muscat echo those thoughts as well. I'm sure Newcastle will be very, very upset. At a crucial time of the season, these players who are playing, who are starters, do not need more games. And especially games that you could basically question, you know, are they really, you could say, games that they really need at this very moment in time. Those who are not playing, no problem whatsoever. But to do that to the competition, in my opinion, shows gross disrespect to the competition. And Graham Arnold should know better, bearing in mind when he was manager of Sydney and Central Coast, he was completely the opposite. And also then he comes out on the other hand and says, well, I don't think you should have, you know, be allowed to have seven foreigners, what the new A-League clubs are talking about. Well, what do you expect the A-League clubs to do if you're going to take young Australian players out for non-FIFA weekends? It's something that needs to be sorted. We saw the situation with Tommy Rogic as well. Mm. It needs to be managed better.
Wow, big from Mark Bosnich. Your thoughts, Louise?
I disagree, primarily because I would rather see our country flourish than look at the individual club's self-interest. That's just purely my stance. I think that the more games, the more preparation these Oli Roux can get before the actual AFC qualifiers, the better it takes them into those three group stage matches. Now, if they don't, if they have no preparation, they're going to go in and they will crash out straight away. But at least Graham Arnold is doing what a youth national team coach should do by organising friendlies and organising proper camps to bring the selected players in to get used to each other and to get used to the way he wants to play.
I'm not sure about this. I usually would side with country over club in every situation, but the Oli Roux, the under-23s, I mean, I think under-23 football is a little bit, especially Olympic football, a little bit redundant. I mean, if you haven't made the senior national team by the time you're 23, then you're probably not going to. There's only a few late bloomers here and there that come through. And you look at the 2008 Summer Olympic squad, which is the last Olympics that Australia actually qualified for on the men's side of things. And you go through, apart from the overage players, which don't really count, there's only a few guys who had reasonable senior team careers. Mark Milligan, who was already involved in the senior setup at that time. Matt Spiranovic, who was only 20 and a younger player in the squad. Neil Kilkenny played a few games here and there for the national team, and James Troisi. Everybody else, you know, are kind of like A-League stalwarts, you know, like Trent McLenahan and Ruben Zadkovic and Matt Simon and so forth. Like, these guys were never really going to be first-team Socceroos prospects. So I think the younger national team certainly need more support. I would really consider, if I was Australia, just not fielding an under-23 side and pouring the resources into the younger age groups, because I think under-23 football is just too late a stage to try and, you know, develop players. I think you need to be targeting the development earlier and trying to blood them into senior football earlier, you know, rather than playing at the Olympics, which is a very much a second-tier competition, and I think it should be replaced with futsal anyway. I don't think the Olympics should have 11-a-side football.
Why not?
I just think there's so many international competitions anyway. You've got your, you know, regional continental comps, you've got your youth World Cups, you've got the senior World Cup. There's so much international football
already. But again, there's no U23 World Cup.
No, but I don't think there needs to be for the reasons I've outlined. I think, you know, more should be placed on the younger World Cups. You look at the club, you know, the teams that have won the Olympics. I think Mexico won it in London, was it? And I don't think they have a single player from that side now currently representing the national team. I don't think this age group really translates to senior success very often.
No, but I think it's fair when you look at different countries in isolation. Clearly, the talent pool in Mexico would be a lot greater than what it is here in Australia, is it not?
Yeah, I suppose. But a lot of African teams have won the Olympics and stuff, and I'm sure it was a seminal moment in their lives and so forth, and you know, a great occasion for those countries. But never translates to senior success. You know,
I think you know what. I have a really good idea about this, and I think it comes back to politics, because when I look at when a national team is picked, the players selected, it all depends on the player at that point in time. What are they doing? What club are they at? Are they getting minutes at that club? You know, so there are all these other factors that come into it, other than the fact that, oh, well, he might have represented Australia at under 17 level. It doesn't work like that. And we've seen it based on current selections. It's also dependent on who the actual coach is and how the politics play into that. Which of his former players he wants to bring into the fold. Do you understand?
Yeah, I know.
So
I totally
there's a lot
that.
Of other factors at play at hand other than the fact that, you know, we have a responsibility to bring young players through to the national team.
No, and, you know, I think this is a discussion that needs to be had. You know, I would rather, you know, how much is FFA spending on the Oli Roos? I would love to know. And if that money could go back to reopening the Centre of Excellence, then I would be all for it. If just disband the Oli Roos if that's the case. You know, FFA is strapped for cash at the moment. We have to really, you know, consider closely what is worth spending money on and what isn't. And, you know, I don't think the Olympics is really that important in the grand scheme of things. For its own sake, maybe. If you really value competing at the Olympics as an athlete in football, but I think it's a devalued tournament, and I would rather see Australia focus elsewhere, because I'd rather see Australia one day win a World Cup than, you know, pour resources into trying to win an Olympic gold medal that, you know, won't really translate to the Socceroos.
Mm. Okay, I agree with points of your argument, but we're going to have to put that on pause for a moment, because the Adelaide Advertiser's journo Rob Greenwood joins us now. Rob, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Good afternoon, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Rob, there have been some explosive reports today. Marco Kurz's two-year tenure at Adelaide United will end in June when his contract expires. Your thoughts on the club's decision?
Yeah, well, look, I think it's one that I guess has been bubbling away for a little while here. I think it's a pretty disappointing decision. I think Kurtz has come in and done a really good job. He's built a really close bond with Adelaide United supporters. To be honest, in my opinion, I think he's really worked wonders with fairly limited resources, a pretty thin squad, and not too much backing in the transfer market. So, yeah, look, certainly I think it's my initial response would be it's a pretty disappointing outcome. Unfortunately, not completely surprising, though, given I guess the climate around the club and some of the events that have been unfolding over the past few months.
And Rob, it's Josh here. And what do you think the fan reaction will be to this news? I would imagine that Marco Kurz is, you know, fairly beloved by the Red Army.
Yeah, he absolutely is. I think if anyone wants to get an indication of the fan reaction, probably just get on their social media on Twitter or Facebook and have a look at some of the supporters' comments sort of in relation to this decision. Yeah, look, as I said before, look, he's really built a strong and close bond with the supporters here. I mean, anyone, even if you've seen Adelaide United matches on TV, his passion on the sidelines and his will to win is really second to none. And certainly from a journalist point of view, having dealt with him really closely since he arrived at the club, look, I have nothing but, you know, the highest sort of things to say about him in terms of his professionalism, his conduct, his knowledge of the game, and his ability to sort of work with players, whether they're experienced players towards the end of their career, young players coming through. and to really get the best out of those players and help them improve, and really just say get the best out of and at times quite thin and a squad that hasn't really been topped up maybe the way it should have been. You know, I think these are all qualities that Marco has shown in his time here. And from the supporters' point of view, I think early indications are that most aren't too happy to see him go at the end of the season.
And we can see just from our Facebook Live comments, Rob, Roger's come through saying, can't believe how Adelaide United have treated Marco. Someone's replied to him saying, except I can believe it, same old Adelaide. So I'm not sure if you share those thoughts. But yeah, I think this could majorly backfire for the new ownership. What do you think are the main motivations behind this decision?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, as I said before, I think the writing has been on the wall, unfortunately, for a little while. It probably stems back, obviously, the new owners came in, I think it was March last year, the new sort of consortium led by Reds chairman Pete Vanderpoel. Obviously, Kurtz was hired by the former owners, which I guess can sometimes lead to, you know, maybe the new owners coming in and wanting to bring in their own people to sort of head up the on-field side of things. I guess the first signs that, you know, the cracks were appearing were sort of around the December, January mark when Kurtz was entering into the last sort of 6 months of his two-year contract. And there was a lot of speculation around whether the club was going to re-sign him. The club then put out a statement, I think it was sort of early January, saying that they had agreed with Kurtz to hold off all contract discussions until later in the season. There wouldn't be any further discussions around it. Well, unfortunately, that really just led to more speculation. And I guess more questions from supporters, from media, from observers of the game, questioning, you know, you've got a really highly credentialed coach here who won the FFA Cup earlier this season. You know, why aren't moves being made to lock this guy into a two or even a three-year contract? So I think that certainly started the process and the speculation. And I guess the press conference last week where Kurtz himself admitted that he'd been trying to get in contact with Pete Vanderpoel for over a month and hadn't been able to, it probably wasn't a great sign either. So, yeah, in terms of motivation, look, I guess only the owners themselves know. Certainly, I guess from our point of view, looking on the pitch, I think he's done really well. He certainly galvanised the squad, galvanised supporters. But as I said, I guess when new owners come in and they have a coach that they haven't hired, they might always have a different view and a different, just a different vision for where they want to take the club and then who they want to be leading the team on the pitch.
Who do you think might replace Marco Kurz?
Look, it's hard to know. Obviously, the decision has only just come through here. One name that I think has been thrown around a little bit is potentially John Aloisi. Obviously, he's an SA-born former player and obviously a highly successful one. Finished up with Brisbane Roar earlier this season, so he's available, has very strong ties, as I said, to the city and the state here in South Australia. So, look, he's certainly one that I think would be in the frame. I guess whether he'd want a job or not is another matter, but I would certainly think he would be a potential replacement. Another name that has sort of bobbed up a little bit in the past few weeks is a Dutchman, Robin Westerman, who is according to the club, is on his way to Adelaide United to take up a community coaching position. He held a similar role with Qingdao Red Lions, who is Adelaide United's sister club in China, who is also owned by the same consortium which owns the Reds. And so Westerman, yeah, a Dutch coach who is apparently on his way to Adelaide to, according to the club, as I said, fill a community coaching role. But who knows? I mean, maybe he is someone that the owners have earmarked as someone that could potentially step in and, if not coach the A-League side, maybe be an assistant or play some sort of role in the coaching team that they're planning. Outside of that, look, I guess it's a bit of an open field. But I think given the Dutch connections with Pete Vanderpoel, with the owners, I wouldn't be surprised if the new coach had some sort of Dutch link.
Yeah, just stereotypically, and it was me spitballing before, I thought they might bring in a Dutch coach, and that connection certainly makes sense. Do you think perhaps Kurz's style of play, you know, doesn't really agree with the new consortium? I mean, stereotypically, the Dutch like to see football played a certain way, and I don't think Marco Kurz, for the results that he's delivered, really falls into that sort of total football category.
Yeah, potentially. But my personal view is I think the owners have to be realistic with the resources that that they've given Kurz to work with. I guess January was a great example where the squad had sort of three recognised centre-backs. The club sold Taylor Regan, got rid of him, so they were down to two. It's pretty well known that Kurz was keen to obviously reinforce in that area. No new centre-back came in. We only have to look a couple of weeks ago where both Jordan Elsie and Michael Jakobsen were injured, and I think Adelaide United lined up with a midfielder and a right-back and a left-back and a three-man central defensive setup. So, I mean, that's just one example of how, Kurz has probably been screaming out for a little bit more support in terms of bringing in reinforcement to a pretty thin squad and hasn't really received them. So, look, I think it's all well and good to have a vision for playing beautiful total football, but I think most Adelaide United supporters are fairly realistic, and at the end of the day, it's a results-driven industry. And he won the FA Cup earlier this season. He finished in the finals last season. The last four games haven't been great, but up until then, the Reds were sitting fourth and on target to earn a home final. So I think if you ask any Adelaide United supporter, a top four finish and an FFA Cup win, I think most would be fairly happy with that. Just in terms of the owners, I think the most concerning thing out of the statement that was released by the club today was a quote attributed to Marco Kurz in that statement, basically saying, "During my meeting with Pete, obviously Van der Poel, I realised quickly that we do not have a common vision for the future of Adelaide United. Our goals are very different, and therefore a renewal of my contract does not make sense." So I guess that says it all. What those goals are of the owners, no one really knows. But the fact that I guess Kurz feels they're some distance apart from his own goals, I guess sort of says it all.
Do you think it has anything to do with the development of young players and bringing them through?
Yeah, look, that's certainly one aspect that has been sort of thrown out there in recent weeks. I'm not sure that's one really that can be leveled at Kurz, though, because, he has brought through quite a few young guys. I think there's about three or four, off the top of my head, teenagers that have made their A-League debut in the past two seasons. And certainly he's one that hasn't been afraid to blood young players and to bring them through and to give them an opportunity. Sometimes he's been forced into that, as I said, because the playing stops haven't been that deep, and they have been hit sort of quite hard with injuries in the past couple of seasons. But I think if the club is more focused on developing young players more than the results, which seems an odd approach to me for a professional sporting club, if that is the case, well, I think Kurz is really ticking that box as well, because as I say, quite a few young guys have come through and have been given their opportunity in A-League under his leadership.
Well, I think we're pretty much in agreement, Rob. I think if the club wants to play better football, then they're going to have to put their money where their mouth is and not just, blame the coach for the results, considering, Adelaide United have, I think, the smallest budget out of the top six teams. So, I'm not sure, as you say, the youth development thing can really be levelled at him. What the goals of the club are going forward remain shrouded in mystery, as this whole consortium has been. So, I'm yet to be convinced that this ownership is really what's best for Adelaide United.
Yeah, it certainly looks that way. I think shrouded in mystery is a pretty good way to sum it up. Obviously, Pete van der Poel, the Dutchman, is sort of the face of the ownership consortium and the chairman. Beyond that, no one really knows who else is on this this sort of leadership group. As I said earlier, there is links to China and to a club there. But other than that, no one really knows. So, it certainly doesn't appear to be, and I'm not surprised, that doesn't appear to be a particularly popular decision not to extend Kurz's contract beyond this season. And I think, the owners really will be probably be facing a bit of backlash from supporters. It's going to be interesting to see in these last few home games of the season what the reaction of Reds fans is. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some pretty disgruntled fans in the stands at Hindmarsh. But yeah, I guess the ball's sort of in the owner's court now. You know, they've got to come out and find a replacement for Kurt, someone that's going to, you know, again, sort of galvanise the supporters and galvanise the squad, and maybe we might see a considerable rebuild. Adelaide United has a fair chunk of players coming off contract at the end of the season, so you know, we might see a new coach coming in, a chunk of players going out, and some new personnel coming in. So, look, it's certainly going to be an interesting few months here with the Reds, and to sort of see how it all unfolds.
Absolutely. And before we let you go, Rob, I did want to draw your attention to the Adelaide NPL side of things and the excellent coverage, I must say, in the Adelaide Advertiser, which I think gives more airtime or space to NPL football than pretty much any other newspaper in Australia. So fantastic stuff on that front. And what's it like having the bona fide star Marcos Flores back in NPL South Australia?
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, thanks for the feedback on the coverage. Yeah, it's certainly been an interesting start to the season, and I think sort of bolstered by the fact we had, you know, a handful of pretty high profile recruits come in. Obviously, Marcelo Carusca has come back here to Adelaide. He's playing for West Adelaide, one of our former National Soccer League clubs. The other one you mentioned, yeah, Marcos Flores lining up for Adelaide City again, another former NFL power. Yeah, look, he's been fantastic. Just a really infectious character as he was when he was here with the Reds in the A League. And some of you might have seen the goal he scored. I think it was about a fortnight ago for Adelaide City inside his own half. So yeah, look, he's obviously a few years older than last time he was here in Adelaide. But look, he's certainly lost none of that flair and that skill, and I think just that entertainment value. He's that type of player that you know, supporters love going out to watch. And yeah, he scored again on Friday night from the penalty spot. So he's had a really positive impact so far. And yeah, look, a great personality to have in the league. And it's been an interesting start to the season. Adelaide Olympics sitting on top of the standings. Probably a club that a lot of people wouldn't have picked to do that well. But again, they've recruited quite well. And quite an open competition here. So we're looking forward to seeing how the rest of the season pans out.
Fantastic. And just before we let you go, FFA Cup coming up. What's the biggest chance of an upset in South Australia? What's your pick for the David versus Goliath turn up for the books?
Yeah, well, we had our round one draw yesterday for the SA phase of the FFA Cup. Some interesting ties. I think the big one that jumped out at everyone was West Adelaide, who we just mentioned before, obviously boasting Marcelo Carusca. They've actually drawn a Sunday amateur side by the name of Tea Tree Gully City. It's away, so it's at Tea Tree Gully's home ground. It's a Chile reserve, so it'll be quite an interesting fall from grace for the likes of Carusca to go from the luxuries of the A-League as a sort of star import in that competition to playing a Sunday amateur side in a couple of weeks' time. So that's going to be a really interesting clash, and you know, as we sort of always say, just sort of sums up, I guess, the beauty of this competition, that seeing that the big boys take on some of these amateur sides and smaller clubs is kind of what it's all about. So I think that's my pick of the standout fixtures. Whether Tea Tree Gully can pull off a huge upset or not, it remains to be seen. But certainly going to be interesting to see how that one pans out.
Well, Rob, keep up the fantastic work. Thank you so much for joining us, and Forza Tea Tree Gully City.
Absolutely, guys. I'll pass that on to them. Thanks a lot for having me.
Rob Greenwood from the Adelaide Advertiser joining us here on Evenings on FNR. Brilliant stuff, and you know, fascinating story surrounding Marco Kurz.
It is. And just to think that the quality coach is now on his way out at the end of June and not going to be part of Adelaide United when he's already done so much for the club. But yeah, Clearly that doesn't align with the way that the chairman wants it run, and thus his contract is not renewed.
If they're willing to actually invest in the team, then I think this is a defensible decision, because if you don't have faith in the manager, then you don't want to put money behind him. And if they want to start with a clean slate, put their own man in, and then actually start, you know, funding the club to an adequate level and not just having two senior centre-backs for, you know, the title run-in, then, you know, that is defensible. And maybe they want to play a certain style of football and Marco Kurz isn't the man to deliver that. If they're just here to try and make money off Adelaide United, try and maybe sell on some young players, maybe that's why they want so many youngsters in the first team.
City 2.0.
Exactly. Then, you know, maybe this ownership situation is not the best for United. And, you know, the supporters are going to have to deal with some tough times going forward.
We'll have to wait and see what happens there. But I've just got some breaking news regarding Sydney FC. Their defender, Josh, Ben Warland, has ruptured his ACL.
Brutal. And that's tough for Sydney FC, considering they do have quite a few injury unavailabilities in the back line. And, it looks as if Aaron Calver is off to, well, that's confirmed, in fact, now, to Western United. So thoughts with Ben Warland, who's been a starter for Sydney in the past few weeks. And Jop van der Linden, hasn't panned out as a good recruit. It was great to see Ben Warland, you know, really step up to the plate as a first teamer. And I wonder, you know, who they're going to turn to now. It might be Jacob Trapp that has to step into that role.
And we've seen him step into that role throughout the season on a number of occasions.
Yeah, he's played a few good games.
He even scored.
Yeah, scored a couple of goals. I think 2 goals, was it, off set pieces. So, you know, he's a danger at the attacking end, certainly. But, you know, a big jump up to be the starting centre-back and not just filling in here and there. So, Sydney FC, their defensive record has been excellent. I think there is a good structure around them to be able to cope with this injury. And scoring goals has actually been the problem. But, you know, certainly unwelcome news on that front.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And Josh, it's time for our favourite segment of the week, our Aussies Abroad segment. And joining us now is the Aussies Abroad expert, Damien Davies. Damien, thank you so much for coming on FNR.
Favourite segment. That's a very very good introduction. Thanks for that, Louise.
Well, there are somewhat more than 250 Aussies Abroad, aren't there?
There is. Yeah. We'll cover them all in one go one day. We'll see how long that takes us.
Probably an hour. I'd have to get my notes out and follow you. But there are some Aussies doing some great things over there and abroad. And there was success for some in the latest round of the Asian Cup.
Yeah, Asian Champions League and Asian Cup. So Champions League first, Milos Dedinac had 90 minutes and Alil won 3-1 last week, which was good to see. Andrew Naboo got a start in the Champions League for his club side. Unfortunately, they could only manage a draw, but great to see Andrew's comeback. It's probably more than a comeback now. It's been a couple of months, so good to see him getting good game time. In the AFC Cup, there was 4 Aussies that appeared. Harrison Sawyer, who plays for a Hong Kong club, had a home and away tie against the North Korean club. So one of the few Australians that has had the pleasure of playing in North Korea. His team did progress, which was good news. Chris Hurd had 90 minutes for his club side. He's still playing for a club in India. Aaron Evans, who is in Indonesia, had 90 minutes. His club side won 7-1. And Isaac Senak, who's in Singapore these days, had 90 minutes, but was on the wrong side of a 5-0 result there. So plenty of Aussies playing in Asian club competitions, which is great to see.
Yeah, so Isaac Senak playing for Home United, one of the biggest clubs, but they're having a bad run lately. So hopefully he can get back to winning ways. But fascinating, the North Korea story. I was reading about Harrison Sawyer's trip there. And I also, quite a while back, interviewed Eric Partaloo about his experiences, you know, playing a cup tie over in North Korea. And I think Harrison Sawyer was actually playing against the team that Kim Jong-un supports and is known to attend games. So, you know, you wouldn't want to celebrate, you know, too wild. Wildly, if he scored a goal.
Well, I think he didn't actually score in that game, so I think he's probably glad about that. there was one more Aussie in the club comp that we need to call out. That's Young Martinez. He was playing for Midtjylland in the under-19 UEFA comp last week. He did get 90 minutes, and they did beat Man U 3-1. So a very, very solid result there.
And I think Louise will be hoping to interview him soon. But Matt Ryan was the big story this week, grabbing the headlines over in the UK with a crucial penalty save in the FFA Cup quarterfinals.
Yeah, I'm sure you've talked about it on various segments over the course of the week, with Brighton getting a 95th minute equaliser going to penalties, and then Matt Ryan making a pretty good save with his feet to make sure that they went through. So Matt was obviously pivotal in that game, arguably one of his most important results for his efforts. He gets to play Man City next. Good luck with that, but I'm sure he'll love the opportunity. And James Meredith was on the other side. He actually represented Millwall. He came off the bench in that tie. So 75 minutes, I think they were 3-1 up, so if I've got that right. So pretty... oh, no, sorry, I've got that wrong. 3-1 up was the Huddersfield debacle against West Ham. Mm. That was my next point. Aaron Moy had 90 minutes and assist, and they ended up losing from 3-1 up to 4-3. They ended up losing 4-3 after being 15 minutes from the line. So that must have been pretty heartbreaking, I would say, for Aaron. So mixed results there for our two Aussies in the top leagues. Down in the Championship, there was a couple of things to report. Bailey Wright seems to have gone out of favour. I think I mentioned that last week. He was unused on the weekend, with Bristol getting a draw midweek and then a loss on the weekend. Meredith did continue as a used sub. And Jackson Irvine and Massalongo both had two games during the week. On the weekend, they did play head-to-head, had a 2-2 draw. So both those guys continue to have great seasons that we've mentioned a few times.
Yeah, brilliant.
League One, bit of bad news there. So the Aussies were all starting midweek, Kenny Dougal, Inman and Burgess. However, on the weekend, Kenny Dougal had to go off around about 18 minutes. He had a broken leg. His Twitter was a little bit misleading. I'm not sure if he actually broke his leg during the game or he's been playing with a broken leg. I'm pretty sure he broke his leg, tried to play on, and then decided to come off. So
yeah,
he's out for the season. Unfortunately, he's had a bit of an average run since he's been across at Barnsley. Best thing that can happen for Kenny is Barnsley gets promoted. That would be a kind of a fulfillment of one of his ambitions for the year. But I think there's already a couple of people on social media commenting that Dougal has had a massive season. If Barnsley don't go up, they'll probably lose him to a Championship club anyway.
Yeah, I would have thought so. And you know, horrible news, obviously, but I think he's probably written himself into Barnsley folklore by trying to play on with a broken leg. That's the kind of stuff they really get into in League One.
That's correct. One thing to call out in League Two, that's Harry Suter. He got 90 minutes and a win on the weekend. I'm pretty sure that's his last appearance before he gets on a plane and comes and joins the under-23s in Asia, in Cambodia. Scotland, a couple of things in Scotland to note. Mark Milligan had 90 minutes and a win and had returned to centre-back for Hibs on the weekend. Ben Garuccio had 90 minutes. His side did lose. And Scotty Mack is probably the talk of the town in Partick. He played in an FA Cup game during the week, which Partick did lose to Garuccio's Hearts, actually. But Scotty Mack scored in that one and then followed it up on the weekend with another score in a draw for Partick Thistle. So Scotty Mack legend continues. We've spoken about it a couple of times, but he's playing himself back into Socceroos contention, no doubt. You can laugh at that one anytime you want. McGowan and Curran appeared for Dundee, and they did lose to Celtic on the weekend, so no shame in that. Dundee have dropped off the pace a little bit, but Curran and McGowan are getting plenty of game time there.
Well, I mean, honestly, given Australia's problems up front, it's pretty far-fetched, but stranger things have happened in football.
They have.
Well, what about the forgotten man, James Holland, over in Austria, who I think is contending for a title?
Yeah, I was doing a bit of research. So James, as we know, left Australia when he was 18. He used to play in the Jets. Had probably about 7 or 8 years overseas in Holland and Austria and Germany. And if you go back and look at his record, he got good minutes at every club he played at in that time. He did come back to the A-League and played for Adelaide for one season that earned him a transfer to China. The China experiment really was not good. I think a lot of people had kind of decided that was the end of James Holland's career, but he went to Austria again, to LASK. Last season made 23 appearances. This year he's made 20 appearances, all of which have been starts. Scored a couple of goals and certainly an unfashionable team, but they're now sitting second on the table in Austria. So everywhere you read, James has had a massive part of their revival at club level. So wanted to call him out this week. Obviously, he played again on the weekend and had 90 minutes and a win, but yeah, he's had a sensational kind of renaissance in his career.
And what about Brad Smith? He seems to have revived his career.
Brad Smith has started the season very, very well. He got a cheeky little assist in a 4-2 win for Seattle on the weekend. So good to see Brad back in favour, certainly at a club level, getting some games. I started thinking about it a little bit this morning. It's going to now be putting a lot of pressure on Bage, who cannot get a game to save himself with PSV at the moment. The next time the Socceroos come into camp, it'll be interesting. I think Jason Davidson renewed his contract, signed another extension today at Perth Glory. Mm-hmm. He's obviously had a great couple of months. Brad Smith, Baij, the left-back position may not be a lay-down midair. Gersbach as well, is he may be at a terrible club in terms of the club performances, but he's certainly getting 90 minutes every week as well. So that will be an interesting selection dilemma where we are hopefully picking players based on form, not based on where they are.
Alex Gersbach is potentially an X factor for me. I just think he's been amazing in all of his, you know, handful of Socceroos appearances to date, and he's unique in his attacking skills from that left back position. So, especially with Graham Arnold in charge of the Socceroos, given he used to coach him at Sydney, I believe, I think he's a huge chance to break into this first 11.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's a good indictment on Australian football as well. The number of players that are having challenges at club level, and once they get the green and gold on, they just go to another level. And Gersbach's probably a great example of that. He's had his challenges in Norway and then France and now in terms of club football at Holland, but he's never let the Socceroos down, that's for sure.
Well, Damien, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut it short because we are just about out of time here on Evenings on FNR, but thank you so much for joining us, and we'll speak to you again next week.
No problem at all. Thanks for your time, guys, and see you next week.
Damien Davies, our Aussies Abroad expert, who is joining us here on Evenings on FNR. But Louise, as we said, just about out of time, unfortunately.
We are out of time, but thank you for your company, Josh, and thank you for your company at home. We'll see you again at the same time tomorrow.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.